This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of lumbar spinal stenosis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Lumbar spinal stenosis is the most common reason for lumbar spine surgery in older adults in the United States. As far as the pathoanatomy, reduction in dimensions of the central or lateral lumbar spinal canal is caused by bony structures and/or soft tissue structures. Bony structures include facet osteophytes, spondylolisthesis, and/or uncinate spurs, which are posterior vertebral body osteophytes. Again, the bony structures that reduce the dimension of the central or lateral lumbar spinal canal include facet osteophytes, spondylolisthesis, and/or uncinate spurs. As far as soft tissue structures that reduce the dimension of the central or lateral lumbar spinal canal, these include herniated discs or bulging discs, hypertrophy or buckling of the ligamentum flavum, and/or synovial facet cysts. So again, herniated or bulging discs, hypertrophy or buckling of the ligamentum flavum, and/or synovial facet cysts are the soft tissue structures that reduce the dimension of the central or lateral lumbar spinal canal. As far as the classification of lumbar spinal stenosis, there is an etiologic classification and an anatomic classification. The etiologic classification is broken down into acquired and congenital. Acquired is then broken down into degenerative/spondylotic changes, which is the most common, post-surgical, traumatic, i.e. vertebral fractures, and inflammatory, for example, ankylosing spondylitis. Congenital is characterized by short pedicles with medially placed facets, like in the case of achondroplasia. The anatomic classification is broken down into central stenosis, lateral recess stenosis, foraminal stenosis, and extraforaminal stenosis. Central stenosis is defined as a cross-sectional area of less than 100 millimeters squared or less than 10 millimeters in the AP diameter on axial CT, and this is caused by ligamentum hypertrophy directly under the lamina posteriorly and the bulging disc anteriorly. Central stenosis presents with nonspecific root compression or symptoms of the lower nerve root. For example, at the L4-5 level, the root of L5 is affected. Stenosis of the lateral recess or the subarticular recess is associated with facet joint arthropathy and osteophyte formation, in which overgrowth of the superior articular facet is usually the primary culprit. Lateral recess stenosis also presents with symptoms of the descending nerve root. For example, at the L4-5 level, the root of L5 is also affected in lateral recess stenosis. Foraminal stenosis occurs between the medial and lateral border of the pedicle. The exiting nerve root is compressed by the ventral cephalad overhang of the superior facet and the bulging disc. Foraminal stenosis presents with symptoms of the exiting nerve root. For example, at the L4-5 level, the root of L4 is affected. Extraforaminal stenosis is located lateral to the lateral edge of the pedicle. Lateral disc herniation causes impingement of the existing nerve root. Moving on to the presentation of lumbar stenosis, symptoms usually include back pain, referred buttock pain, and/or claudication, in which pain is worse with extension, like walking and standing upright, while pain is relieved with flexion, like sitting, the classic leaning over a shopping cart, or sleeping in the fetal position. Symptoms can also include leg pain, which is often unilateral, weakness, bladder disturbances, and remember that recurrent UTI is present in up to 10% of patients due to autonomic sphincter dysfunction, and finally cauda equina syndrome, however this is extremely rare. Physical exam may reveal the Kemp sign, which is unilateral radicular pain from foraminal stenosis made worse by extension of the back. A straight leg raise or the tension sign is usually negative. A Valsalva test is characterized by radicular pain not worsened by Valsalva, as is the case with a herniated disc. Many lumbar spinal stenosis patients may have a normal neurologic exam. Patients may have no focal deficits, as the exam often takes place with the patient seated and symptoms may be reproducible or exacerbated only with lumbar extension or ambulation. As far as the differential, it's important to differentiate symptoms of neurogenic claudication from vascular claudication. Flexion improves symptoms in neurogenic claudication because this posture increases the limited area available for the neural elements in the spinal canal and foramen. But let's compare neurogenic claudication with vascular claudication on a few different parameters. As far as postural changes, neurogenic claudication is affected by postural changes while vascular claudication is not. As far as walking upright, this causes symptoms in both neurogenic and vascular claudication. As far as standing stationary, This causes symptoms in neurogenic claudication, while it relieves symptoms in vascular claudication. As far as sitting, this relieves symptoms in both neurogenic and vascular claudication. As far as stair climbing, going upstairs is easier for neurogenic claudication patients because the back is flexed, while going down the stairs is easier for vascular claudication patients because the back is extended. With respect to the stationary bike with the back flexed, this relieves symptoms in neurogenic claudication patients, while this causes symptoms in vascular claudication patients. As far as pulses, neurogenic claudication patients have normal pulses, while vascular claudication patients have abnormal pulses. As far as imaging for lumbar spinal stenosis patients, standing AP and lateral radiographs may show nonspecific degenerative findings like disc space narrowing and osteophyte formation. It may also show degenerative scoliosis and/or degenerative spondylolisthesis. Flexion extension radiographs may show segmental instability and subtle degenerative spondylolisthesis. And plain film myelography provides dynamic information such as degree of cutoff when a patient goes into extension. However, this is an invasive procedure. With respect to MRI, findings include central stenosis with a thecal sac of less than 100 millimeters squared. Other findings may include obliteration of the perineural fat and compression of the lateral recess or foramen, as well as facet and ligamentum hypertrophy. MRI findings of spinal stenosis may be found in asymptomatic patients. Bowden et al. Found that 3 of 14 asymptomatic patients had MRI findings of anatomic spinal stenosis. Moving on to CT myelogram, this is a more invasive test than an MRI, and findings may include central and lateral neural element compression, bony abnormalities, and/or bony facet hypertrophy. This modality is useful for patients who can't get an MRI for some reason, like patients with older pacemakers, shrapnel, etc. With respect to treatment for lumbar spinal stenosis, there are non-operative and operative options. Non-operative options include oral medications like NSAIDs, physical therapy, weight loss, bracing, and corticosteroid injections, and these tend to be the first line of treatment. Steroid injections, that is, epidural and transforaminal, are effective and may obviate the need for surgery. As far as operative options, the two major options are a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression or a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression with instrumented fusion. The indications for a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression are persistent pain for 3 to 6 months that has failed to improve with non-operative management. And another indication is progressive neurologic deficit, like weakness or loss of bowel and/or bladder control. Outcomes of a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression include improved pain, function, and satisfaction with surgical treatment. The most common cause of failed surgery is recurrence of disease above or below the decompressed level. Comorbid conditions are the strongest predictor of clinical outcomes after decompression for lumbar spinal stenosis. The indications for a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression with instrumented fusion include presence of segmental instability, like an ischemic spondylolisthesis, degenerative spondylolisthesis, or degenerative scoliosis. Another indication is surgical instability created by complete laminectomy and/or removal of greater than 50% of the facets. And remember that there is a risk of adjacent segment degeneration greater than 30% at 10 years, which is another indication for a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression with instrumented fusion. As far as the surgical techniques for a wide pedicle-to-pedicle decompression, a single-level decompression at L4-5 would include resection of the inferior half of the spinous process of L4, resection of the L4 lamina to the level of the insertion of the ligamentum flavum, resection of the ligamentum flavum, medial facetectomy and lateral recess decompression, which involves undercutting of the facets and removal of the ligamentum flavum from the lateral recess, then finally exploration and decompression of the L4-5 and L5-S1 foramen. However, be sure to palpate the L4 and L5 pedicle and be sure the nerve root is patent below it. With respect to a wide decompression with posterolateral fusion, instrumentation is controversial, but circumferential fusion with P-lifts or T-lifts is accepted, but there are no studies showing its superiority. Finally, let's talk about some complications. Complications increase with age, blood loss, and levels fused. Major complications include wound infection in 10% of patients, and remember that deep surgical infections are to be treated with surgical debridement and irrigation. Pneumonia can occur in 5% of patients. Renal failure can also occur in 5% of patients. And neurologic deficits can occur in 2% of patients. Minor complications include UTI in 34% of patients, anemia requiring transfusion in 27% of patients, confusion also occurring in 27% of patients, dural tear, and of course, failure for symptoms to improve. That's all for this review about lumbar spinal stenosis. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.